The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
The Buddha was once asked to describe his practice, describe the Dharma in brief. And the most succinct, he was asked this several times, and he had different answers each time. So, you know, there's different ways to describe the practice in brief. But one of the most succinct was a phrase, he said, "Nothing whatsoever should be clung to as I or mine, I, me, or mine." And so this points to the, it's both an exploration of the teaching. You know, what does it mean to cling? What does it mean to cling to self? And it's also an exploration of practice. So this is the topic I'd like to explore today, is the topic of clinging and letting go, because the exploration around clinging is, nothing whatsoever is worth clinging to. So letting go of clinging is one of the main practices. Now, why? Why would we let go of clinging? And why does the Buddha say that nothing should be clung to? It's not some random idea or random thing he thinks, you know, for some arbitrary reason. He points to this because from his own experience, from his own exploration of his own mind, he saw that this process of clinging is a huge area of suffering for us. And his whole teaching was really framed around, why do we suffer, and is it possible to be free of suffering? So, you know, Buddhism sometimes gets a bad reputation because it seems to be so focused on suffering, 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 suffering. But at the same time, the exploration, the question the Buddha asked is it possible to be free from suffering? And I think that's something we're all interested in knowing. His approach was to explore the things that are in the way, you know, the things that make us suffer. To not try to just leap over it and deceive ourselves or kind of package into some small area of our psyche and say, okay, you know, that stuff doesn't exist. But really to open to how our minds work, how our minds get engaged in the world in ways that create suffering for us. He looked in terms of what we have some agency over, that we're not going to be able to change the... There's a teaching in the Buddhist teachings called the eight worldly winds. And these are things that happen, you know, the worldly winds. We think of weather, you know, weather is stuff that happens to us, right? And, you know, we may get frustrated by the weather, but it's not like we think we can change the weather. Maybe some scientists do think they can change the weather, but you know, it's not like we think we can change the weather, and so we learn to adapt and learn to be at ease with the weather if we want to be at peace. And the eight worldly winds that the Buddha talked about were praise and blame, gain and loss, pleasure and pain, and fame and disrepute. And he said, these things are going to come at us. You know, people in their doings of stuff in the world, us in our doings of stuff, these worldly winds will happen. It's not something we're doing wrong if somebody praises us or blames us. It's not something we're doing right necessarily if somebody praises us. It's not necessarily something we're doing wrong if somebody blames us. These things happen to us. There's always going to be somebody with an opinion about what's happening, what you know, somebody with an opinion about who we are and what we're doing. And so if we are reacting to that, if we are wanting somehow to change the opinions of people in the world, you know, probably not going to, not that, the Buddha thought, that's not the root, you know, trying to get everybody in the world to have a good opinion of me. How about if instead I see if there's a way to be at ease with these eight worldly winds? So many different ways that we struggle and suffer. You know, the pain and pleasure. That one, just that one. When there's painful stuff happening, when our bodies hurt, when we're sick, if we have illness, we get into accident, you know, that physical pain is challenging for us. It creates unpleasant experience in the body, and what tends to happen is that our mind reacts to that. We don't like it. We want to get rid of it. We hate it. We're averse to it. And so we add to that unpleasant physical sensation an unpleasant mental experience, which multiplies the pain. And so the Buddha's exploration around these eight worldly winds and the exploration around the ways that we suffer is how might we be able to essentially not give over our ease and peace to the conditions of the world. We suffer in societal terms, we suffer the pain of war, perhaps. People in the world are suffering in so many different ways. The pain of war, the pain of starvation, the pain of discrimination. And it's not to say, I mean, that one of the teachings here, you know, one of the explorations around this teaching, it may be interpreted that what we're saying when we explore the possibility of being at ease with the conditions in the world, that we are not trying to change the conditions in the world, and that's not necessarily the case. And that's not, that's the exploration is how can I be at ease with this moment and using a peaceful mind to step into the next moment and seeing that there may well be actions that need to be taken to end war, to meet and say no to discrimination. And those responses in the world. What the Buddha said is that the peace and the ease, it's possible to act from ease and peace. Ease and peace doesn't necessarily mean that we don't act. But it perhaps means that we act in a way that brings compassion rather than aversion. So that's an important piece of this exploration. That this exploration of not clinging to wanting things to be other than they are also doesn't also mean not acting. So that's just a very important piece to understand. We have personal pain, pain of loss of loved ones, pain of loss of job or relationship. And our minds also, our own minds, we struggle with from our conditioning. We may have habitual kind of ways of responding to the world that might lead us into feelings of loneliness, despair, depression, frustration, aversion, anger, not feeling understood, not feeling seen. So the Buddha's exploration in his own mind was that all of this suffering, you know, the way that we suffer around all of these things. He's not denying that there is war out there, and not denying. In fact, the Buddha tried at one point to stop a water war between two neighboring tribes or kingdoms. And he went and physically put his body between the battlefield to try to get people to stop fighting over water. So this was action. He took this action. He wasn't successful, unfortunately. And so, you know, this is action without anger, action out of compassion, and action acknowledging sometimes people do deluded things, and we can't necessarily stop that. The peace in our own hearts we don't have to give away. And so the Buddha has explored the why and how we suffer in our own hearts, where peace goes away from us. And he found that in his own exploration that this clinging is a huge part of that. There's two pieces to this. There's the craving, which is wanting, essentially wanting a certain outcome, wanting a situation, wanting to get rid of something, wanting to have something. This wanting kind of sets into motion our reactivity. So this wanting things to be other than they are essentially leads to actions, trying to either hold on to something that we have, which is slipping away because things are impermanent, or trying to get rid of something that we don't like. So our usual relationship to experience is one of craving and clinging. The way that we relate to the world is often from this perspective of wanting to hold on to things that we like, wanting to get rid of things that we don't like, and believing that that is where happiness lies. So this process of craving and clinging includes greed, wanting to have things a certain way, aversion, wanting to get rid of things we don't like, and delusion, the belief that the having and the getting rid of is where happiness is found. So the Buddha decided to explore this craving and clinging to see, you know, he saw in his own mind that a lot of his suffering, and he came down to the suffering, not the pain of life. I mean, the physical pain of life, he said, that's just part of being a human. You know, that's just part of having a body, that kind of pain. But the mental pain, he said, that's possible. He found in his own mind, that's possible. To not be in mental pain. In fact, one of the descriptions of freedom is no mental pain or grief. So he said that was possible, and his exploration of it was that the mental pain and grief that we experience is set into motion essentially through craving and held together by clinging. Kind of like the linchpin of the suffering is the clinging. And so I'd like to explore this because one of the things that the Buddha really emphasizes is not, you know, just listen to this and believe it, but a real exploration in your own experience. What is the... You know, looking in your own experience for how your suffering is created with the tools of mindfulness, with the tool of mindfulness and concentration together, begins to reveal how our minds work. And that revealing of how our minds work, the mind itself begins to understand how it's clinging and how to let go of that clinging. So there's so many different ways that we cling. The teachings of the Buddha actually enumerate four kinds of clinging. I'd like to go over those, kind of an overview of those four kinds of clinging. And, that's gonna be a broad brush overview. And I thought maybe in coming weeks I could explore one or another of these in a little more depth. So the part of the understanding, I think, that's helpful is that there's so many ways that our minds deceive us, so many ways that we don't see things because of views, because of opinions, because of perspectives that we hold. And so some of what the Buddha offers is an exploration of a shift of perspective. And with that shift of perspective, we then can look at our own experience, perhaps with a little bit of a, shaking up around our perspective. So this one major shift of perspective is that the mental pain and grief that we experience is not caused by other people doing things to us. That's a condition that leads to our reactivity. So it's two aspects. There's the causes of the world, which include these eight worldly winds, includes the weather, it includes your genetics, it includes how you were raised. All of the conditions of your life have come together in this moment to create how you are, to create that you are sitting in this room right now. And the Buddha pointed to any mental struggle that we're having in this moment is not due to all of that, but is actually due to how we are relating in this moment to the conditions that are present. And we tend to kind of cling, crave things to be pleasant, cling, crave to wanting to get rid of the unpleasant. So that's a kind of shift of perspective in a way that, I think before I really started practicing, there's some way that I believed that when somebody did something and I got angry at them or felt hurt by them, that they did that to me. And in exploring the practice, exploring the mind with mindfulness, I began to see, there was something that happened out there. And then there was a reaction born in the mind, often related to some idea. They shouldn't have done that. And so the reactivity in the mind, this is where the Buddha pointed us to look at. How are we relating to the world? So the four kinds of clinging that the Buddha talked about, and I'll just name these quickly and then try to go say a little bit about each one. Includes clinging to sense pleasure, which is clinging to wanting things to be pleasant in our experience, clinging to views, clinging to opinions, ideas, beliefs. This third one, clinging to rules and observances, that's a little harder to describe. It's not so much in our culture, but it's basically around clinging to the belief that certain behaviors will lead us to happiness. I'll describe that more. And then the fourth is clinging to a belief in self, identity view, personality view, self view. I'm going to start with clinging to rules and observances because it's the briefest. It's so this is I think it really grew out of the time of the Buddha, in which there were a lot of different religious practices available at the time. And some of them were really, there was a kind of belief that if you just did these things, bathing in the river Ganges, that you would purify yourself. There was one practice called the dog duty ascetic. And this was a practice of behaving like a dog, running around on all fours, barking like a dog, not speaking, eating food that was thrown to you. There was a belief that this would lead to a purification of, basically of desire, I think, because you were basically, you know, it was kind of a mortification practice. So these kinds of practices, there were beliefs by people that if you did that really well, if you behaved perfectly like a dog, then there would be some reward in the future. So the Buddha actually, his emphasis isn't so much on the actual behaviors, but more on looking at what is our motivation behind our actions. And so he said, you know, certain behaviors, like behaving according to the precepts, for example. This is the precepts that we explore in terms of non-harming, right? We explore refraining from taking life, refraining from taking what is not given, refraining from sexual misconduct, refraining from false speech, and refraining from intoxicants. You know, we could engage with those just with the belief, if I just do this, you know, that action itself is purifying. And the Buddha emphasized it's not so much about the action, it's more about how the mind is. Are you engaging in that activity of non-harming with compassion and a wish for peace and ease in your heart? Or, I mean, it's possible actually to engage in those actions blindly without reflecting on their purpose or meaning. And so the Buddha really emphasized this reflection on the intention behind our actions, that the actions themselves only have the power to free us if they are associated with wholesome qualities of mind, if they're associated with wisdom, with ease, with peace, with compassion, with love, with joy, rather than being associated with greed, aversion, delusion. So this teaching on rules and observances is just to begin to look. For us, it may not be a big part of our lives that we have these beliefs, although there's certain rituals perhaps that we may engage in. It might be interesting to look, are there certain rituals that we engage in, and are we engaging in those rituals with intention, or are we just doing them out of rote? You can sit in meditation out of rote without really looking at what you're doing. So this is this exploration around clinging to rules and observances. It's not that the precept, I mean, the precepts are really helpful. It's not that we jettison our training rules, but that we learn to engage in them with an intentionality of mind. And it is that intentionality of mind where the learning happens. And then the second aspect of clinging around sense pleasure. Now this includes both wanting to create a world that gives us pleasurable experience, finding pleasant things to have in our experience, good food, nice soft things for our body, warm buildings to be in, all kinds of things like that. Just just wanting pleasurable experiences. It includes that. It also includes wanting to get rid of unpleasant, this exploration around sense pleasure. So this is, you know, a lot of what motivates our lives. If we really start to look at our behavior, a lot of what we do is motivated by trying to kind of construct a world in which we feel good. And this is very natural. In a way, our bodies are set up to want to feel good. The body is essentially, you know, designed to go towards well-being. And yet what I think the Buddha is pointing to is that fundamentally there's a big veil over our minds that we believe that simply getting what we want and getting rid of what we don't want is the best way towards well-being. So there's a lot of delusion in our minds around how well-being can be found. And we learn this. We learn this from the time we're children, right? We get something that we like, and there's a moment of like, oh, that's nice. That feels good. We have something that we don't like, and it's like our body gets tense and tight, and we think, I got to get rid of that. So we learn this, having things and getting rid of things as a way to feel a sense of a few moments, at least, of relaxation and ease. And we think that's how happiness is found. That we just have to string together enough moments of sense pleasure and getting rid of the things that we don't want, that that's where happiness would be found. And so this is one of those shifts of perspective that the Buddha offered us, that he discovered, it's kind of a surprising thing when we actually see this, that it's not so much about the getting. When we observe this whole process of getting something that we want, getting something that we don't want, there is a moment, a very few moments, of pleasure or ease around the having the thing that we want or the getting rid of the thing that we don't want. There's a very few moments of kind of pleasant experience around that. Another piece of the pleasure that comes with the getting what we want, getting rid of what we don't want, is that the unpleasantness of wanting goes away when we get what we want or get rid of what we don't want. And I would like to propose, and this is something the Buddha suggested, that the wanting, that the ending of the wanting there is actually the greater part of the happiness that is to be found in having what we want or getting rid of what we don't want. And what we can explore the possibility of is looking at the wanting itself and the clinging to wanting things to be a particular way. And for certain things, again, this gets to that question around action in certain cases. But let's just talk about sense pleasure for now. Let's just talk about the objective around sense pleasure. You know, having some chocolate or something like that, just something really simple. Let's just look at something simple right now. If you can see the urge to have chocolate, to see that urge and watch the urge, not act on it, but watch that urge disappear. If you can hang out with the urge for long enough to see it disappear, you may discover the actual peace that comes when the mind lets go of wanting. We don't see this so much when we get the thing that we want, because the pleasure of the having is kind of obscuring the pleasure of the letting go of the wanting, the ending of the wanting. But if you can, from time to time, I'd encourage this, with some small wanting, look at this. when I'm on retreat, sometimes I play with this around, you know, little wantings, just to see what happens when the wanting disappears. It feels like being released from a vice grip. It's quite amazing how powerful that movement is in the mind. And so that release brings an ease that is possible without having to endlessly construct, without having to endlessly find things that make us feel good and get rid of things that don't make us feel good. So this process that we undergo so much of our lives, the actual like trying to construct this world, it's exhausting. It's exhausting. And that's another part of the suffering around this clinging to sense pleasure, that we exhaust ourselves trying to make the world the way we want it to be. And then we beat ourselves up when it's not possible. The worldly winds will keep blowing. Pleasure and pain. It's like, you know, we think that our happiness is about getting what we want, getting rid of what we don't want. And the whole belief around that, that's a lot of where the clinging is in this realm of sense pleasure. It's clinging to this idea that having what I want will make me happy. So the exploration around sense pleasure is not to deny ourselves or try to push away pleasant experience. It's not the sense pleasure, it's not the pleasant experience itself that is the issue. Pleasant experience will come, pleasant experience will go. In fact, one thing I've seen in my own exploration of experience is that when I'm not trying to hold on to pleasant experience and figuring out how to, you know, do all this mental gyration around constructing the world the way I want it to be, when I'm not trying to do that, simple, small pleasures are actually experienced more deeply. You know, the chocolate. I was shocked on one retreat. Somebody gave us some chocolate one afternoon, and I took my piece of chocolate and, you know, put it in my mouth, and I was just exploring, you know, how long does this pleasure last? This is one of the instructions the Buddha says. Look at the pleasure. Look at the gratification that comes with pleasure. Acknowledge that there is a little bit of happiness that comes with pleasure, but then see, how long does it last? You know, look at how long does that pleasure actually last? And that's an interesting thing. And sometimes it can be surprising, like I found with that chocolate. You know, the chocolate, it was really amazing. I had no idea how long the pleasure of chocolate would last. You know, put it in my mouth. It was really, really pleasant while it was in the mouth. You know, really pleasant. And then it kind of, the flavor dissipated. But the happiness of chocolate actually seemed to last for a long time. It lasted for about 5 minutes. I mean, it felt good. And I mean, I think that I know something about chocolate and endorphins. You know, it's like, you know, it was kind of shocking. You know, 5 minutes of pleasure from a piece of chocolate, that was like, wow, that's pretty amazing. But still, it's 5 minutes, right? It's not, I mean, when that 5 minutes goes, you're like finding another piece of chocolate. And if you're not paying attention to the gratification of pleasure, you're probably putting another piece in your mouth before you've even finished chewing this one. So, you know, exploring that, this is one of the things that Buddha said, explore the gratification, watch it. I found that smiles are great, you know. You have a smile, an exchange of a smile with somebody. And I was exploring this on my walks, you know. How long does the gratification of the pleasure of a smile last when I see somebody smile? 30, 40 seconds, you know. It's quite interesting. And then it faded. But if I wasn't holding on to it, or trying to create something or construct something in my mind, these pleasures could be felt, and then there wasn't the struggle or suffering when they went. You're like, oh, what's the next thing? What's the next thing? So the danger around sense pleasure is not the pleasure itself. It's the belief, the holding that I have to have this. I have to get rid of that. So it's the the clinging that is the danger around the sense pleasure. And so looking at our sense pleasure, looking at the gratification, acknowledging the happiness that comes from that, and, you know, it's fun. It can be fun to explore that with mindfulness. And then it can also be fun to watch that, you know, that shift and then be ready for something new. As opposed to having the idea, the next thing I need to do is, instead we're available for what's here. Views is another piece. Views are a huge area of clinging. I think in many ways, all of the kinds of clinging really kind of come down to views in some way or other. The clinging to rules and observances is around the belief that the action itself will lead to happiness. A view, an idea. The clinging to sense pleasure, a lot of the reason that happens is because we have the belief that having what is pleasant, getting rid of what's unpleasant, is the way to happiness. It's a very deeply conditioned belief. Very deeply conditioned belief. And so, you know, this exploration will be with us for a long time. A very long time. So views, clinging to ideas about how things should be. Views about the world, views about ourselves, views about other people. Views are often obscured. Often because we've lived with them for so long that it's like it's the air we breathe. We don't notice them because they're just the way things are. So views can be a challenging area to explore. And the Buddha has identified a couple of specific ones around rules and observances, around sense pleasure, and again later around the sense of self. Specific ones to look at, but he also suggests looking at views in general. Our views of who we are, who other people are, how the world is, create a kind of a filter that we meet the world through. It's like we have a set of colored glasses on that is our view, and because of that view, we see the world in a certain way. We tend to gravitate to see things that confirm a view, and we tend to not see things that don't confirm that view. This comes back to also not just views, but agendas. And, you know, what we're something that we're trying to do, an orientation in the world to something we're trying to do. If we're oriented to a particular activity, we may miss some things. I had a very clear example of this. And in some ways, it's part of the way the mind works. It's a useful feature of our minds that when we have an agenda, that we see certain things and don't see other things. It's a very useful part of our minds. And yet, we believe, one of the views that we seem to have is that we believe that our sense apparatus are accurately recording the world. And that's where the view, the delusion, the problem comes in. Because we believe that what we are seeing is an accurate representation of reality, but it is filtered, obscured by what our view is or what our agenda is. So this example, I was participating in a experiment. It was about, what they call it, it was an experiment around just this notion of paying attention to something and, you know, how long the mind kind of orients to pay attention. It's, I think it's called, I can't remember the technical term, but it's something about as soon as the mind orients to something, there is a gap or a a period of time during which the mind orients to that thing and doesn't see other things. So this is a feature of essentially perception and attention in the mind. And they were curious whether that attention gap or whatever had a certain... They thought it was hardwired. They thought that attention... when the mind oriented to something, that there was a certain period of time during which nothing else could be taken in. And so that was part of the experiment. They wanted to know, does long-term meditation impact that window, that attentional window? And they had a group of people who just meditated in daily life and a group of us who were sitting the three-month course at the... at IMS in Massachusetts. And the experiment was to send a stream of letters and numbers before our eyes. We looked into this, these lenses, and it was like, I don't know if you've seen The Matrix, you know, it's like those those numbers. It was like that. It was a stream, just a falling stream of numbers and letters. And primarily letters with a few numbers interspersed. And they said, there will be one or two numbers in that stream, and your job is to identify the numbers. And the first time I did this, it's like, whoa, you know, the mind could not see any numbers. It was going so fast. I don't know how quickly the letters were changing, letters and numbers were changing, but it was really fast. And at some point, after a few times, the mind began, I had the agenda of picking the numbers out. The mind began to be able to find numbers in that stream. And to my surprise, it was kind of cool, actually. When the mind saw a number, it was as if the whole stream stopped for like half a second. And that number hovered, sitting there in my visual field. I really got a chance to look at it. And then it vanished. That hovering, that was the attentional window that they were looking at. The mind went to it, saw it, and in that attentional window, while the mind was seeing that hovering number, there was no possibility to see the numbers that were actually, the letters that were actually streaming by in that moment. The mind did not see the streaming in that moment. So this is an example of ways that even a simple agenda like this can prevent us from seeing other things. Now, it did turn out that the meditation, the 3 months, it was so interesting in the meditation, after the 3 months were over, did the same experiment again. And I learned as soon as I saw a number to relax. Because what they had done was to embed another number in that attentional window. And their checking was to see, you know, does meditation actually make it possible for that attentional window to diminish? So that we're, and this is actually, I look at this actually as a kind of clinging, right? You know, in a way, it's a form of the mind grabbing onto something and holding it. At a very deep level, not something that we typically can look at. And in fact, what I saw is that as soon as I saw a number, I could relax. And then the stream came back immediately. And I could pick out the other numbers in the stream. So this is just an example of how our minds work. And, you know, the clinging at this level is you know, it's not something that we're going to typically be able to see. But just to point out, I mean, the thing that I want to point out here is that when we are attending to something, we are missing something else. And the belief or the view that we are seeing everything is a large part of how and why we end up suffering. We attend to something, we don't see something else, and, you know, we end up in quarrels with people, in contention, in dissent with people. Around this difference of view. So looking at views, what is it that we believe? This is an interesting exploration. Our beliefs about who we are, our beliefs about who other people are, we tend to see things from that perspective. If we tend to believe that somebody is habitually late, somebody is habitually late all the time, then we create that, idea. We may tend to notice the times when they are late, but not notice the times when they're not late. It's like, that's an anomaly. That's not who they are. We kind of dismiss that. So, just looking at what our views are and recognizing, do they limit us? Views about ourselves actually are pretty limiting. We believe who we are, what we're capable of doing, and the belief itself about that view can cement that into place, a self-fulfilling prophecy, essentially. And so this is a big area of exploration, and I like to encourage people to recognize, essentially, what thoughts are you believing? What thoughts are you believing? Thoughts themselves will arise, and this one exploration for myself around this was around thoughts of self-hatred. Thoughts would arise, you're no good. I believed those thoughts for a very long time. I believed those thoughts. You're a failure. You can't do this. The main way it arose was you're no good. That was my habit. That was the thought that was very habitual. So that belief. So the thought arose, and then there was a believing of that thought. And what I began to see and explore in the practice was looking at the thought and then recognizing that the belief was actually separate from the thought. So the thought arose, and then I could kind of begin to tap into, how much do I believe that thought? How much do I believe you're no good? Sometimes the belief was strong. Sometimes it was kind of like, wow, there's that thought. Huh. And sometimes it was in the middle, kind of like a little bit of believing it. So I began to explore, this, looking at this, the level of belief. So looking at the thoughts and how much do we believe them? We don't have to, when believing is happening, we don't have to tell ourselves. I mean, it's possible. It might be you could say to yourself something like, "Well, I might be wrong." that kind of bringing that in. I might be wrong. And yet, sometimes the belief is so strong that that idea, "I might be wrong," is just like, "Well, yeah, right." I know this is true. The believing is so strong that it comes to the level of truth. The belief, you're no good, so strong, it's just truth. When it's that strong, it's powerful to acknowledge there's that thought and there's belief. There's believing that thought. Something about, and that's that believing is really where the mind has taken hold of that thought and cling to it. So that, it's like, yes, that's true. When the mind is really believing something is true, to say that it's not true, or to say it might not be true, sometimes the mind doesn't want to take that in. But it can sometimes acknowledge, yeah, believing is happening. Believing is happening. This is powerful, to simply acknowledge what our beliefs are. And then we may start to see in that acknowledgement, oh yeah, believing is happening. That creates a tiny bit of distance, a little space around that belief, as opposed to being like wrapped into the world of that belief. We're looking at that world from just a little distance. Gives us a little bit of space, begins to allow the mind to start to release that belief. Again, and sometimes we believe things that, could be objectively true. I mean, I have now come to the, you know, understanding your no good thought is, I mean, actually the belief in that thought is largely gone. The thoughts still come. The thoughts still come, but there's just like no traction. The believing process doesn't follow on from that thought. Then there are things like, you know, thoughts that happen that have perhaps a little more objective truth to them. You know, the thought around discrimination being wrong, that I think has some objective truth to it. So the practice here isn't to say, you know, all of my beliefs are wrong, but to recognize here's a thought and here's a belief. And then in seeing that belief, any kind of complex of aversion or reactivity around that belief can begin to not motivate our actions around that belief. So we see the possibility of engaging from that perspective without hostility, without ill will. So I didn't get to the last one. I'll talk about that next time. The clinging to identity view. So thank you for your attention.